accession number 4666, rule 3.
Lord Gridley, rule 3.
Organisation in Changi Jail.
All right.
That's what you want, don't you?
Let's move on to the organisation. Mm. Start off by talking a bit about the Japanese administration and hierarchy.
Mm.
Can you identify the main figures in the Japanese hierarchy? You know, their titles and their functions.
Yeah. Now, you asked me a question about that, about Japanese hierarchy. It's difficult for me now, with any accuracy, to tell you who they were right at the beginning, because they were transistory, the first people we had there. But during that period, I will tell you who they are, who the Japanese commandant was in a moment, the permanent Japanese commandant.
Yes, I'm interested primarily in the structure.
The structure. Mm. Right, well, the structure was that you had a Japanese commandant. He had about five Japanese personnel under him whose job was to patrol the various areas of Changi Jail. We had guards, rather moth-eaten looking guards they were, I didn't wish to be insulting to them, but that's obviously people who would not be fit to take any part in their fighting forces. Their job was to take us out on outside camp duties, which primarily was growing vegetables for consumption within the jail. We had some odd characters amongst them who were pretty capable of giving you a slap on the face or giving you a kick on the shins, something which you certainly didn't know why. What it was all about, or why you'd receive that sort of treatment. Some of them were quite reasonable, others were not reasonable at all. I think that's basically, you had the commandant at the top, you had administrators underneath him, three or four, you had guards, about four or five of them.
Four or five of the whole camp? Or
Yes, they were on a roster. They may have had people living outside. There were people living in quarters outside the jail, which are obviously occupied by warders in the normal sense, occupied by the Japanese. I couldn't say with any give you any accuracy the numbers employed, but I'm giving more or less a structure which would be in daily operation at any one time within the camp.
Numerically, quite few Japanese in evidence then?
Yes, there were quite a few, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Of the ones that were in evidence, what were their prime functions and interests?
Well, I think their prime functions was to see that we didn't make contact with anybody else while we were outside tilling the earth to grow vegetables. They were exceedingly strict about that. We were not allowed to talk to anybody or make any sign to get in touch with anybody, and of course to see that we didn't sort of push off, leave, and that we were always checked. As we went out through the main gates of the jail, our numbers were given to the chap who was on duty at the gate, and similarly we were checked when we came back. Once we were inside the jail, if I may make it clear, we were allowed to wander anywhere you like. And the exercise yards go from one block to another, go and see your friend in A block or B block. There were three main blocks, A, B, C, and D. And 300 cells on each block, one, two, something like that.
What I'm interested in is whether there were any aspects of camp life that the Japanese themselves were directly administering?
I don't think so. If I can get to you, I think I must take you now to how we set ourselves up as an administration. I told you that Changi Jail had its own kitchen, it had its own hospital, it had its own administrative block. In the early days, we negotiated with the Japanese to set ourselves up under some kind of democracy. I won't go into the structure of democracy at the moment. Basically, this meant that we were responsible for allocating people to cook up rice in the kitchen. We now knew how many people were interned in the jail, and a rice ration was worked out in argument with the Japanese between our representatives and theirs. We didn't get sufficient rice, as I told you, but basically put that in now.
How was the camp run? What was the system of a democracy?
We decided that we would have to have some organization for dealing with the Japanese. The best way of doing that was to have it run democratically. We therefore appointed, first of all, elections followed subsequently. It was necessary to get some organizations set up. We appointed our own camp representative. Under him, he had a committee from each block of the jail, a committee of men. His committee was composed of a representative from A block, B block, C block, and D block. Those blocks represented a number of cells in each block. This formed the camp committee. We had every kind of expert interned at that particular time, and therefore doctors came onto the committee as well, for a nutritional sense. Any other point before
I... Yes, I still don't understand how these original officers were appointed. By what system?
Well, they were elected. They were elected subsequently. They were appointed. The point was, first, we'd just gone in. The basic thing to do is to set up an organisation of experienced administrators in that sense, who would represent the interests of the 1,800 people that were then interned in that jail. The first basic thing was to get the Japanese to give us an adequate ration.
Would I be right in assuming then that the way the committee first established itself was simply by the leaders naturally leading?
That's right.
Elections followed?
And elections followed very much later, yes.
How much later?
3 or 4 weeks later.
Oh, that's not so long. No. I thought you were going to say 2 or 3 years
later.
No. Those elections organized?
Well, on ordinary voting democratic basis, you put up for election. People would suggest somebody should represent your block and represent your floor. It was a question of the internees themselves selecting their leaders. And I mean, I became a deputy block commandant.
And this was literally by secret ballot?
By secret ballot, yes. We set up a form of democracy in our jail. And I think that basically was right. I mean, after all, it was only right that the chaps should be in a position to choose their leaders, having seen them in the conditions in which everybody at that time was suffering. And it was no sinecure. I mean, to be appointed to a position of that responsibility where you were representing these chaps meant you were competing. It had a bloody good slapped face, and because you were almost fighting to get better conditions for those you represented.
So am I clear now? There was a camp representative, there were block representatives, there were deputy block representatives.
That's right.
Were there any other officers or officials?
Basically, no. Not running the camp. There were experts. The camp committee would appoint the doctor of experience in turn to be in touch with the camp hospital. The camp committee would represent to the Japanese the requests of the doctor in charge of the prison hospital. The people in the kitchen requiring assistance with fuel and that kind of thing to cooking the rice would represent their interests again up to the camp committee. In fact, it was the camp committee and the camp representative who was responsible for all requests made of the Japanese to keep us alive. The Japanese were really not interested. They would not take the initiative themselves. They would expect us to come to them and put up a proposition to them. And basically, they would turn and they would cut down. They would cut down our requests by half. I mean, they'd think we were asking for too much. There was always a fight to get through our organisation the basic requirements necessary to keep us in a reasonable state of health. I mean, and that's putting it mildly.
Mm. Who were the past personalities who first made up the Kent Committee?
You want the names?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll switch off for a moment. I'll have to think.
So the Kent Committee was sort of cabinet, if you like, and it also had this role of dealing with all communications between the internees and
that's
the Japanese.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Did the members of the committee have any other functions?
Well, I mean, how much do you want me to tell you? I mean,
as much as you remember.
You see, basically, in the end, I mean, we've settled down. We're in there now, and then this huge organisation started up, which money was smuggled into the jail, which I think I told you at my original interview. The camp committee had their fingers in that because, as I say, as the war progressed. Now, do you want me to, I know this from my personal experience.
Now, you were a deputy block representative. What did that mean?
That meant if the block, the block commandant or block representative went ill or anything or was taken out, I had to take responsibility for the block and I had to negotiate with the Japanese and have my face slapped so good and proper if I asked for too much in their opinion. I had an experience where I had ordered a part of the wall to be knocked out. We'd had carpenters there. Basically, we were an organisation which ran our own things. I say we had doctors, carpenters, electricians, everything. One day I noticed that our chaps who'd been sleeping in the block dining room, about 40 of them in a very small area, were suffering from heat. So I ordered somebody from the workshop to come along and knock a hole in the wall. A hole in the wall, not with the outside world, but onto the exercise yard, and let some air come into place. And inspection took, you're asking me my experience, an inspection took place subsequently, and I had to go around with the Japanese commander. I hadn't asked him about this, about knocking a hole in the wall to let some air in. And he said, who did that? I thought, well, my God, I thought this is the end of me. I said, I did it. I thought the only thing to do, it's no good. I mean, it's no good sort of saying I didn't do it or having everybody up on, punished the whole place, punished because nobody would say who did it, so I did it. And I expected the most fearful thrashing from this man. And he did the opposite. He just smiled and did nothing. I can't explain it. I mean, I did something which was absolutely heinous in the Japanese eyes to have done something like that without getting permission from them, but he did nothing. You asked me, that was one of my experiences. Yes. Other experiences, I had to line them up during on the Japanese, the Emperor Tenohiko, as they called him, his birthday, line them up in the prison yard and scream at them to stand to attention, which I did in Japanese. And I can give you the Japanese words, which was kiotsuki, which was I used to ask him to say kiyotsu, which meant standard attention, while the Japanese commander came round. And when he'd finished examining our blocks, say yazume, which means stand at ease. Those are my functions. Other functions were to occasionally attend meetings of the camp committee and represent a particular interest or express a certain opinion about things. To the camp committee and so on.
Did you have regular duties on a daily basis, or primarily you were sort of first reserve to the camp the block representative?
I was more or less first reserve to him.
So you mostly came into operation when
he
was
unwell? I came into operation,
yeah.
Mm. I mean, I went out with the working parties occasionally. So on. Basically, the thing was to keep oneself alive. You used to ask me, what is the organisation? What would we do? I used to clear people out of their cells, the sick out in the morning, and say, you've got to clean your cell out. We don't want any bed bugs. We don't want this lice flying around. Everybody's got to do something. It was my job to select those people from my floor who were fit enough to go out and do the heavier work of digging outside on the outside parties. That was my job, one of my jobs. One had to be quite ruthless on occasions, particularly with the semi-sick, to keep a man, keep his sanity, to keep him realizing that he was worth something and that he mustn't shrivel up in the corner and die, was to get him out of his cell in the morning, thin or weak as he was, make him clean his cell and be quite brutal about it. Pull him out and make him do it. That was part of my job as well, and the job of many others of us who did that kind of thing.
As a matter of interest, did you ever get involved, perhaps representing the bloc when the representative wasn't available for any reason, in presenting a complaint to the Japanese administrators?
I don't think I was personally involved in anything like that. Which would be of value to report. I might have gone along there. I can't remember any particular occasion now. I can remember that incident, as I've told you, where I was expected to get in awful trouble over knocking that stone out of the out of the wall.
You would know what the procedure was, though,
to deal
with that. How would it be actually handled?
In what way do you mean?
Well, if an ordinary internee had some problem or complaint, or if there was some general problem or complaint that needed the attention of the Japanese, how would that?
It would be represented through our camp representative. They wouldn't tolerate any complaint by any individual. It all had to come through the camp representative himself. They were not interested. They hadn't the time, and I don't think they had the staff. Latterly, they hadn't to deal with individual complaints. They did allow us the list that latter. We were responsible, and I think we ran it exceedingly well, if I may say so. I think that the way we kept people alive subsequently, I told you about the way we had these secret receivers and so on. I don't know whether we're getting on to that now. But
no, we'll come on to that in a minute.
We were a most efficient, I suppose we were sort of a communist state. We ran our internal lives more or less on, we were dictatorial in some ways. You had to be. When men are dying and you want to keep them alive, you've really got to give them orders. You've got to say, you've got to do this, and you've got to be a leader on those lines.
Were the kinds of instructions that had to be given through the office internee officials, were they always obeyed?
Generally speaking, yes, they were. The force of one's... not personality. You had to establish your ascendancy over those people for whom you were responsible. You had to be capable of exercising a certain amount of leadership. You had to convince them, really, that what you were telling them was for their own good, however terrible it was for them to perform what you were requesting them to do. You had to impress on them that the lives of not only themselves, but all of us, depended on them acting in the way they were told to act, and that we were all sink or swim together. And it was quite amazing how the cooperation you would get in those circumstances. People realized they were up against it, you know.
Were there any exceptions?
One or two, yes.
Can you give me an example?
I remember we did a brutal thing when later on. There was one chap stole some food out of the kitchen when we were short of food. So we built a cage and locked him up and put it in. It wouldn't give him any food and said, look, that's the chap who's going to steal your food. What a so-and-so. What would happen if we all stole each other's food? Men, in certain circumstances, become like animals, you know. I'm sorry, but I mean... This
yes. Any other examples?
I don't think... I can't think of anything where... Basically, we were human, but I mean, there were some times when you felt you really had to... You had to be cruel to be kind in no uncertain terms. I can remember getting hold of chaps who were sitting on their backsides and lying in their cells not doing anything and watching these crawling things going up the wall and getting this chap out by the scruff of the neck and giving him a room and saying, you've got to get down to this, you know. I don't want to see anything like this. What? How? They used to suck your blood, these animals, you know.
Mm.
And you can stink. I mean, you could prick them and they're great awful. Do you know what they look like? Horrible things.
Apart from enforcing authority by the strength of one's personality,
yeah.
Was there actually any backup system by way of a camp police, by way of a camp court for dealing with...
Nothing like that at all. It never became necessary. I think the circumstances were so harsh that really wasn't necessary. You had to convince, as I said, by what I've described, for these people to.
You've mentioned that the Japanese were generally pretty hostile.
Mm.
Were there any particularly good or particularly bad?
Yes, I can explain. There was one westernized Japanese, educated in America, spoke perfect English, who deplored the conditions which he saw that we were suffering under, and who did every conceivable thing in his power to alleviate.
For example,
by getting us in extra medicine, getting us perhaps an extra ration of one duck's egg a day or something like that for the internees. And which was a luxury for the evening meal, one duck egg and some sloppy rice, as opposed to having rice and water. An egg was lovely. Little things he tried to help us with. That was one that I can think of. He was always prone to listen to the individual complaints of any particular internee and would listen. Sometimes he would try and do something about it. I think he always did try, but he wasn't always successful. That is an example of Japanese who helped. There was another. You have to realize, again, I'm digressing, but this man was a lieutenant in the Japanese army, and in that camp we had one or two Gestapo fellows moving around who were sergeants. And he had to take his orders from the sergeant, and the sergeant could report a lieutenant under their system, and a lieutenant was for the high jump if he was considered to have been acting in a subversive manner in their eyes for a report of a sergeant. So he worked under, what I'm explaining there, he's worked under great difficulties.
This is the westernized one you're talking about.
The westernized, great difficulties,
yes.
Poor chap.
Any other particularly good or particularly bad Japanese?
There's one. You got them, for instance. We had a small Japanese who looked at only as big as Pinocchio or whatever, like it was called Puss in Boots. Wherever he was about, he always took a swipe at you and you got out of the way. I mean, he's a little sod, you know. that was a type. Another type. Some of them were very funny. I remember one occasion when I was sitting down, he spoke a little English, and he was sitting down in a corner of the exercise yard one day, and he'd come up and try and be friendly, and he'd speak sort of broken English and broken Japanese, and he would try and show a British ship and Japanese Navy fighting in the Pearl. I don't know, we didn't know where they were, but he'd say, he'd show all our ships going down and the Japanese ships, you know, that kind of camaraderie, an exhibition of perhaps trying to... I think he was as bored with the period as we were.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a sort of a bit of a description of what went on.
Did you, or as far as you're aware, any of the other internees establish any... close relationships with any of the individual Japanese camp personnel?
Only that lieutenant, I'm telling you, close. I don't know how close one would describe that. As close as you could get in war, you would realise that man was a human man, and therefore you would respect him. And you could always do that. You could exhibit that by, when you meet each other, smile at him or touch a cap to him. And yes, he was a very reasonable chap, and we got on exceedingly well. But you couldn't get very close to the Japanese. A, it wasn't permitted, and they were damn lazy. So I, for instance, one would have thought, describing later on Tominaga, the Japanese commandant, he'd have come round the jail a great deal more and seen the trouble and distress of the internees themselves, but he didn't. He kept in his administrative office outside. All he would do would be to listen to the camp representative, the camp committee, asking for alleviation of the troubles which people were suffering. No, he didn't come round. I mean, I think this is an extraordinary thing. You would have thought he would have done. But, you know, the Japanese exist on very little food compared to what we Western chaps were used to. And I think it's undoubtedly true to say that there'd be many more deaths from Changi jail and the awful circumstances in which we lived had we not been in the tropics, because I discovered that you really could... You could exist on very little. A ration of rice and some fruit, perhaps one meal a day, and some liquid. You got very, very thin, but you got your body adjusted to that small amount of food. And I think if it had happened, if we'd been in those circumstances in a European winter, we'd have died. But you were kept warm under a tropical sun. And so, what am I saying? I'm saying that while obviously we were suffering very badly from malnutrition, it did establish the fact that it is nevertheless possible to live in the tropics on very little food indeed.
Going back to the question of relations with the Japanese and thinking about discipline, what were the most common offences in Changi for which internees were punished?
They were punished for asking for what the Japanese considered were. When you say the internees were punished, now I must keep to the internees rather than the camp committee. Generally speaking, you would get the British are dirty people, aren't they? I mean, you've only got to look at the streets of London. They're filthy people. I mean, I'm so disgusted when I go around London today and I think what the Japanese did to us in this jail. This, again, projects itself rather further on than we've got in this talk. You asked what the Japanese did. When we got our first issue of Red Cross cigarettes, of course, people smoked them and chucked the butts on the floor and all this kind of thing. And the Japanese came around. They were simply furious about this. They are a very clean race. And so they slapped the faces of the people that they'd seen doing this and created merry hell going through the jail. And they got empty tins on string and put them around the necks of the people who'd perpetrated this awful offence to them. And they were made to go around like that for the next fortnight or 3 weeks with something around their neck and a tin, and they had to stub their cigarettes in there, and the Japanese would go around and see whether it was full or not. Those kind of things. Basically, they didn't interfere with us very much.
Mm. That's rather a good one. Punishment fitting the crime.
Yeah.
Were there any other kinds of activities by internees that would be punished?
No, you see, I think I can explain this to you rather well. When the punishment came, or when there was any punishment to be done, punishment generally was a punishment for doing for espionage or something like that, in which you might have got yourself mixed up in according to their lights. They would then hand you over to their to their torturers, to their people who would either be trying to get information out of you or to punish you in another way. They seem to have, perhaps, in their system, a system which was responsible for meting out punishment for all kinds of things in the way I have described to you, and even applied to their army, I believe. They were permeated with these Gestapo people. I mean, they had them stationed in their army, their sergeants and so on. They had them in the jail there. And should you do anything wrong, really, they would... You were for the Japanese Kempeitai. I'm sorry, I said Gestapo. Kempeitai is the proper word I should... it's not Gestapo, it's German Gestapo. It's known as the Japanese Kempeitai, K-E-M-P-E-I-T-A-I, Kempeitai. That's the way their system worked. Fine.
So what was the most extreme treatment you had at Japanese hands?
Well, extreme treatment was what's known as the double tenth in Changi, when they sent in the whole of the Japanese Kempeitai into the jail one morning. We didn't know why they were there or why they had come. Everybody was taken out of their cells. Japanese forces went up onto each floor with bayonets, and they were there for the whole of the day in that position, while certain Japanese went through all the internees' possessions in the jail. And of course, people had a considerable amount of stuff which they had collected during that time, and I'm talking about notebooks. We'd had lectures and that kind of thing in operation. So there's a good deal of written material that was to search and so on. This went on the whole day. The whole of us were outside in the prison exercise without any food in the blazing sun for something like 12 or 14 hours. At the end of that time, about 10 people were arrested at the end of the first day of their visit, taken away to Singapore for further interrogation by the Japanese Kempeitai. Over the next five...